You know that song.
I Don't Want to Face It.
Yeah, and that is the song, besides being the posthumous Milk and Honey release for John Lennon from the Double Fantasy Sessions, that is the song of infamy that apparently, you know who, the gopher of Lennon's, spirited a demo out to Julian Lennon.
Right, absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And Julian got slapped back, apparently, by Yoko, probably owing to the fact that she was going to put out John's version.
Yeah, and John's version, of course, was never finished. We get the kind of basic track, the rhythm track with the vocal, which obviously I'd always prefer to hear the Lennon vocal, but those guys did a really great job of filling out that song.
Yes, exactly. It's, you know, it's almost as if, and I don't know if this was their intent because I never asked them about it, but had John lived to finish that song and do a decent arrangement, if that's what they were channeling, like how would John have done this if he had lived to finish it, or if this is just their own spin on it. But to me, they took a recording that, you know, obviously was at a disadvantage because he never finished it and turned it into something.
Yeah.
And by these guys, we mean the Fab Four.
Yes. I like the harmonies on it and just how, you know, when they're singing the refrain, they really have filled it out with sort of high harmonies and
put the flesh on the bones of John's version.
And sounds really good.
That really cool drum pattern that Rich Pagano does, the drummer. And it's a really nice take. And they did this, I guess, for some charity release for Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really speak to it because I don't own it, but I've seen the video and it's a great track.
Well, it makes a change for me to like something by a covers band.
So. Right. Exactly, because covers band general principle, I would never paint them with that broad brush because that covers a lot of ground.
Yeah,
but these guys are truly exceptional.
Well, because they're not just trying to sound exactly like the record, or clearly, you listen to that and they're doing it in their own way.
Yes,
be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Unlike maybe a lot of the listeners, I'm not into the covers bands. It's not my thing at all. I don't like the lookalikes or the soundalikes or the people with the phony accents and, all the witty repartee and all that stuff. It actually really bugs me and sort of run a million miles from that stuff. And
You're a big Elvis guy. Do you like Elvis impersonators?
No.
Okay.
Although, except for one in Britain who was great. It was a Welsh Elvis impersonator, but an Indian guy from Wales in a turban in the jumpsuit.
Cool.
Yeah, that kind of did it for me.
Okay, but I thought you were going to say PJ Proby.
Right. But in the case of, as I say, Beatles covers bands, not my thing, but I did listen to, the Fab Four, and I love
it. It's different.
It is because they've got balls.
You check that out?
Yep. very good. Let's not go there. God, it's cheap digs from Rodriguez today.
Yes, they've been on my radar as the guys that do it right because they deconstruct the music, they get inside the Beatles' heads and what exactly they were doing and with what tools in the studio to create these sounds.
Right.
And it's not that you need this embalmed note-for-note recreations. They get the essence of it and the spirit of it, and they put a bit of their own artistry in as well. But they don't go out there impersonating. It's a five-man act. They're multi-instrumentalists. And to me, it's like what the Beatles... had it been a parallel universe where they were performing post-66, this great material, what it might have sounded like.
You know, what's really interesting to me is that we never got to see the Beatles in the second half of their career on stage, right?
No.
So we didn't basically see them performing Pepper or the White Album or Abbey Road.
Well, the closest we came was Rock and Roll Circus, where John did your blues with those other guys.
Yeah.
Not nearly as well, in my opinion, as it's on the Beatles record.
And of course, the Get Back project, Let It Be, and they're not exactly on peak form there either.
Although they pulled it off for the rooftop thing.
Yeah.
Took a couple takes for some of the songs, but it showed the possibilities if they'd had the will and had done, what was basically everything from 68 onward was largely basic rock and roll material.
Mm-hmm.
They could have, maybe augmented by a Billy Preston, they could have done live and done it well.
Yeah.
And we don't have to dream anymore because the Fab Four at the Chicago Theater, as they did at several other sites or cities around the country, did the White Album start to finish.
Right. Well, I don't know if I'd go as far as we don't have to dream anymore. It's, no denigrating the Fab Four, but I mean, it still isn't obviously the Beatles.
It's not the Beatles.
They would be the ones.
As close as we get to it,
right?
Minus the stupid costumes and accents.
Absolutely,
this is the pure music with life in it. Yeah. It's not embalmed. It's
It's not. I mean, in some ways, it's a note for note copy, but they do add their own feel to it, right?
Yeah,
They don't try to sound like Lennon or McCartney.
No.
They do it in their own way, which I really appreciate.
Right, they get the gist of it. They get what is important about that music live without massively reinterpreting it or doing it note for note like some other bands might. It's really refreshing. It comes to life.
It's also really nice that on some of the numbers they jam a bit. So you get an extended instrumental.
Right.
Yeah.
Where you have the fade outs on the record, you know, they just run with it.
Absolutely.
And not in any way a bad way. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I got the chance pre-Chicago show to talk with Frank Agnello of the Fab Foe. He's a lefty, but he doesn't stand there playing Paul McCartney left-handed bass. He actually plays guitar mostly. He played bass on Good Night, but that was because Will Lee was actually standing up doing the vocal. Right. But Frank does some of the Paul vocal parts, does them very well. And got to talk with him before the show at the hotel lobby. So if you hear a little ambient noise, that's what's going on. But he was nice enough to give us some time before the sound check. And I will also point out, it's not part of this conversation. I mean, we edited it out just to streamline the talk. But when we talked on about Revolver, just as a sort of side note, we're sitting in a hotel lobby and all this music is being played. All of a sudden, Yellow Submarine comes on. Just like that serendipitous at that moment. So it's kind
of
funny.
Well, of all the tracks, though, to come on.
Exactly. Because it wasn't like they're playing 60s music or Beatles music. It was a random mix. We start talking about Revolver and all of a sudden you hear, in the town. You know, it was very strange, right on cue. The first thing I asked him about was what it was like to be in the Beatles' footsteps, as it were, performing at the Ed Sullivan Theater and performing at EMI Studios at Abbey Road.
I felt the same way that I felt at the Ed Sullivan Theater. I felt this is a place, the air seemed really heavy. This is a place where a lot of things have been done by a lot of people.
Yes.
I just, you know, right away you get a feeling there's a certain... there's an ambience there that it's pretty hard to ignore. It kind of hits you, and that's how I felt about it, Abbey Road.
Did it seem smaller in real life than you envisioned?
A little bigger.
Did it? Oh, wow.
Studio 2 seems a little bigger to me. And Studio 1, of course, is huge.
Right.
I mean, we took a peek in there. Yeah.
Did you go in 3?
We didn't go in 3 because I think Paul was remixing stuff for...
New?
No. This was in 1999, so whatever he was working on then... Yeah.
Run Devil Run, maybe?
Maybe. He was. I remember seeing the sign on the door, closed session, no one admitted unless directly involved. And we had a tech, who Alex, he was, I think it was his 20th or 21st birthday then, so maybe he's still there. But he was splitting his time between Paul's session and ours.
Oh. Well, let's start with the White Album, which you guys are doing tonight. And one of the things that I'm sure you get asked a lot is, do you do Revolution 9? And I'd read this, but you can flesh out the details of it. Is that how you guys sort of reverse engineered the tape loops that were used in the production of that and came up with your own? So you're not sampling any authentic Beatles stuff. What you hear as somebody attending the concert is stuff that you guys came up with on your own.
Yes. It sounds exactly like it. That Schumann piano piece, we could have taken a recorded example and done it, but Will actually played it frontwards. And thanks to Walter Everett's book, you know, the Beatles as musicians, the Schumann piece, the excerpt that's used in Revolution Number 9 was there. Will played it in real time frontwards, and then we just made it backwards, sounded exactly identical.
Wow, very cool.
Other stuff, when we still had a Tower Records, I took a trip to Tower Records and tried to find all of the recordings, and again, Walter Everett helped a lot with his book, and there were other things on the web where I found the source, and I was even lucky enough to find some EMI recordings, so maybe I found the ones that they used.
Very cool. It's one of those kind of holy grails among Beatle fans to find who was that EMI engineer that says Number 9 that they looped throughout the thing. I don't know if anybody's come up with an identity to go with that or the uncut audio that it was taken from. So one of you guys is doing the Number 9 throughout?
Yes, Will recites it.
Okay.
I think Mark Lewison might have pointed out, it's been a while since I actually read that, but somewhere I think it was pointed out it might have been just a test engineer at some point for EMI who said it.
Yeah, immortalized.
And of course, they ran it backwards and they thought it was Turn Me On, Dead Man.
Yes, there's so many weird serendipitous things with the backwards recordings. The one that comes to mind is the Free as a Bird at the very end of that.
Oh, yeah, right. Right, there's a little comment right at the end of the the baritone, banjo uke.
Yeah.
Piece. Yeah, I remember hearing that.
Came out nice again, which I guess was the George Formby catchphrase.
Oh.
And you turn that backwards and it sounds like by John Lennon.
Wow.
It just blows your mind when you hear it reversed.
Yeah.
So, in the Beatles catalog, where does White Album rank as something to perform?
near the top. Revolution 9, as we found out, has become a bit of a performance art piece, which is probably not the way the Beatles envisioned it. We even got some positive feedback in a way when we played it for the first time in Liverpool. There were some kids who wrote on a message board, oh, enjoyed the Fab Four doing Revolution 9. Kind of reminded me a bit of the Goons, seeing them recite it, you know. So we took that as a compliment.
Very cool. As you guys know, having studied all this stuff, that Revolution 9 actually has a rhythm to it that's built on the extended take of Revolution Number 1.
Yes.
So is that something you guys perform underneath it while you're putting the effects on top? Do you keep that going as sort of a framework?
No, actually we go closer to the way the recording turned out.
Oh, okay.
So we just tried to listen for everything, all the major things we could find and that we could perform with five people. Actually, we expanded to six because we have Jim Boja help us with one of the parts. He does the mysterious megaphone singing near the end.
Oh, okay. And somebody plays Yoko?
Yeah, we have a recording that was made back in 2001, and we do have a person reading that part.
So, of the Beatle albums, do you have any that are personal favorites for you guys to perform live as an ensemble that you really look forward to doing in a performance mode?
Well, I know I could answer for my bandmate, Jack Petruzzelli. He's definitely his favorite. Top of the heap would be the White Album. Mm. And it's up there with me, too. Uh-huh. There are certain things about all the albums that are really great. Mm-hmm. My observation about Pepper, maybe, is that it goes by too fast.
Really?
It's not a very long album, it seems. But it's a lot of fun to play. Rubber Soul is a lot of fun. I mean, the five that are often cited as being, you know, the five major works in a row, they're really extremely enjoyable to play.
Now, you guys in your career, you don't limit yourself just to the four Beatles catalog. You also do some solo Beatles stuff. You did your Lennon versus McCartney show. You guys have done the George Harrison tribute. Is there anything you guys picked up in deconstructing these songs in order to perform them that you made some sort of observation about how they worked separately versus how they worked as a collective? You know, it might have been different musically, different approach. Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind on a lot of John Lennon's recordings, and he's actually visited both sides of this issue, I think. With Plastic Ono Band, it was really basic and grassroots. But then you get to some of his other 70s albums, and it's, you know, session players. It's that whole session player vibe. So he looked at both sides of that. And that comes to mind when doing a song like Whatever Gets You Through the Night. I mean, there's... you know, a lot of, just great New York session people sound on that one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a song that screams. I always think of Saturday Night Live every time I hear it.
Oh.
That opening.
Yes, because the high saxophone note at the beginning.
Yeah.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Which, before there was a Saturday Night Live.
Yep.
He kind of laid the blueprint for it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you pick up on any different musical approach between Lennon and McCartney, how they work together versus separately?
Well, with Lennon, of course, definitely a different approach to lyrics. I think it was said once about McCartney that he applied the utmost care to his lyrics, but sometimes they didn't they sounded more like they were tossed off than Lennon's did, whereas Lennon's were more literate. McCartney's were crafted maybe for sound and impression,
yeah.
Impressionistic in a way, more than saying something that was super profound.
Yeah, with clarity and precision.
Yeah.
He would go for what scanned well and was memorable, mm-hmm. A good turn of the phrase.
Yeah. I mean, you may not know exactly what the lyrics to Jet are, but they're pretty easy to remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a song about one of his sheepdogs, supposedly. But,
right, or puppy, depending on what
puppy,
story you hear.
Yeah. But the lines are, maybe not telling a especially profound truth, but the words are, I don't know if ear candy is the right way to say it, but they stick in your mind.
Yes, and not to be dismissive or lightweight, but ear candy is something pleasing to listen to that absolutely engages your ear.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a sense, it's pretty clear in the Beatles' career when they were working in the sort of friendly competition between John and Paul. You know, John would write a great song and Paul would come back with his own, you know, John does I Feel Fine, Paul comes up with She's a Woman.
Or Brian Wilson would write one and Paul would come back and then Brian would come back with one.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you get much of a sense of that in the solo years, that they were still listening to each other and that other things that they did individually were very much influenced by something the other might have done?
Yeah, well, definitely around, I can think of a few examples right away. I mean, just the little snapshot included with the Imagine album where John is holding, you know, holding a sow's ears the way Paul held the ram's horns.
Yes.
And, of course, I believe the Dear Friend is an answer song to How Do You Sleep? And another one would be Let Me Roll... No, Beef Jerky is an answer guitar lick to Let Me Roll It.
Now, you guys aren't known for playing a lot of the covers that the Beatles recorded earlier in their career, say the BBC or Star Club era, any of that stuff. Are there any cover songs you guys would like to include, and what would they be?
The only ones we've done are Some Other Guy and Cry for a Shadow.
Mm.
We haven't done Cry for a Shadow in about 10 years. We did it when we played the Cavern Club.
Oh, cool.
Some Other Guy, though, we do regularly when we do a Cavern to the Rooftop show. Oh, and we also do Leave My Kitten Alone.
Okay. Have you ever been tempted to incorporate some of the BBC stuff in?
It's come up. You know, we still haven't hit all 213, though after the City Winery shows at the end of the year, we'll be up to 210.
Oh, wow.
So we only have three left.
Okay.
Which three would that be?
Matchbox, I'll Get You, and Real Love.
Interesting.
If you want to do strong material, and sometimes the strong material is the really well-known stuff, but there are a lot of hardcore Beatle fans, so you want to mix it with some you know, off-the-beaten-path ones that just come off really, really strong live. This is an example of that tonight with Me and My Monkey. I don't know if the Beatles ever played that from beginning to end the way it appears on the record. I think there were some splices in there.
Oh, absolutely. You can hear them.
And, you know, just playing that one live, that's always been a crowd pleaser.
Everybody's Got Something Tied Except For Me And My Monkey. I mean, a favorite track of mine, not the favorite, but one of the favorite tracks of mine off the White Album, amazing vocal by Lennon.
Yeah, amazing performance all around, that where the bass kicks in toward the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. But the way these guys do it live, where it goes on like three times the length of the studio recording.
Impressive.
Yeah, you must see this, folks, if you have a chance to see the Fab Four, because they are amazing, and they realize the potential, that little two-minute bit that is on the White Album. They just flesh it all the way out. And
absolutely.
It's really worth your time.
Something else really interesting in that interview. I have to say, I didn't know, or never really thought about.
Never put it together.
Right, is this whole thing about beef jerky being a kind of response to Let Me Roll It. You got that guitar part.
Yeah, very subtle.
It
but
is.
It's there.
And I mean, we don't know for a fact that that was a response.
But I think
Lennon,
if you're a musician, you could pick it up. If your hands are on the frets, you play the Let Me Roll It lick.
Yeah.
And like, oh, that's just a, you know, it's a variant of that beef jerky lick. I mean, I think that John was very deliberate. I mean, it comes after Band on the Run, which we know he heard because he praised it.
Right.
And there it is. I mean, I don't think he ever explicitly said, yeah, beef jerky, I threw that in there as like a response to Paul. He didn't need to.
But yeah, but that's what's really cool because, I mean, I have to tell you, I love the part of Lennon that's in everyone's face. No subtlety whatsoever, right? Like, how do you sleep? It's like subtlety takes a vacation.
Right.
You know, and Lennon's firing on, you know, all cylinders. I love, though, that we've got this here, which, if true, and it seems to be, is him being completely subtle. He's sending a musical message to Paul.
Yes, and but he was also the same guy that said sometimes we'd drop a beat out of a song to see if anybody noticed.
Right.
I think that's what he's doing here.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to throw this lick in and see if anybody notices.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
Yeah.
So, on to the Fab Four again. Rich, the drummer who you spoke to.
Yes.
Great insights. He's a guy that wrote an article defending Ringo's drumming to all these idiots out there that think he was just some, you know, lucky guy,
right,
and it could have been any drummer.
Right, right, yeah, right.
I love the fact that, you know, you're able to draw him out on what made Ringo special.
Yeah, it was a really actually a fascinating interview because he gave me quite a bit of insight about Ringo's sort of technical ability, which often isn't, you know, spoken about.
No, not at all.
And about, you know, just his drumming style and how he himself had to learn the parts and then adapt to that. So
right.
Let's take a listen to this.
Yeah. Also, I would say that Rich, you know, if you have this vision of the Fab Four never having seen them and think that he's just sitting there singing Octopus's Garden and, you know, with a little help. No, he actually does a lot of Lennon vocals.
Right. Absolutely.
And there was the thing he did on TV?
During the 50th anniversary celebrations earlier this year, in like February, they were on the Letterman show.
Yes.
And we're going to hear a bit of that.
Rich on vocals.
With Rich on vocals, the drummer
on
vocals.
Don't stick to roles. You know, it's not like Rich just sings Boys and Honey Don't.
Exactly. And what I love is with the vocal, he's not trying to sound like Lennon. It's I'm the Walrus. He's not trying to sound like Lennon. But it's got, as I said, dare I say it, the ballsiness. You know what it is. It's got edge to it.
Yes.
And it's just really credible. I was amazed. And they also, you know, their shows that they're doing at the moment, they're doing a series of shows where they do entire albums.
Yes.
So there'll be one night they do the White Album.
The White Album in Chicago.
Yeah, the White Album in Chicago. But they're doing, actually, I checked them out because you can go to the website, fabfo.com. And on there, it's got their touring schedule.
Yes.
And you'll see that actually they perform all of the albums, all of the UK albums, and some of the American versions as well.
They say schedule, don't they? Not them.
No, that's right.
In Britain.
In Britain, yeah. Schedule.
Yeah. Okay.
And, yeah, and garage and kilometres, you know.
Right, boot.
Yeah, yeah, the real language. Anyway, as we were saying, so yeah, why don't we take a listen, first of all?
Yes.
To I'm the Walrus.
Yes.
And then we'll segue into my interview with Rich.
There you go.
Germany with the late Hiram Bullock in late 97.
Do you find that over time you've actually become more of a band? Were you kind of trying to impersonate them more at the beginning and then you've just moved towards your own interpretations?
Oh yeah, in the beginning it was note for note. It was everything down to the T. I mean, we never sang with accents.
Right.
You know, I mean, I gravitated more towards the John vocals only because he and I had the larger noses. Whenever I would do a Paul McCartney song, you know, he had that sort of nasal purity When I would do Paul, even though I do a couple of Paul songs, I sound like Pete Townsend doing Paul.
In terms of the instruments, do you guys, you know, use the same guitars, the same bass, same drums? I mean, how does that work? Or are you just playing to, you know, your own strengths and in terms of the choice of instruments?
It's a hybrid. I mean, the guitars are accurate.
Yeah.
These guys are using vintage period guitars. I mean, the amount of guitars that we use are incredible. You know, if you see our shows, you'll see, you know, 20 guitars on each side of the stage. The keyboards are, some are old, but most are new, because you can't bring old keyboards on the road and expect them to last. And the drums are not Beatle drums. The drums are, one kit is a new kit. And by the way, we have two kits on stage, one early years and one later years.
Years ago, when I interviewed George Martin, he said to me that Ringo may not be, you know, technically the greatest drummer, but he said he gets a sound that is all his. He said the way he tunes his drums is unique. Are you mindful of that in terms of how he tunes his drums or his drumming style? You know, because basically, you know, he was a left-handed drummer playing on a right-handed setup, giving him a sort of idiosyncratic approach to what he did. So were there any particular Beatle tracks that were especially difficult for you to figure out and pull off?
Oh, every fill he plays is difficult, because I had given up. I mean, for a bit there, I would try to start my fills with my left hand, because that makes your right hand go to the right side of your kit more quickly. So you will really never master Ringo if you don't adopt that. But as I got older, I just felt, you know what, I'm thinking way too much about it. Instead of doing it for every fill, I'll do it maybe for two or three fills. But that is the essence of Ringo. That and where his backbeat sat, which was like a little bit behind the groove, but not really dragging it down. That's a big piece of information for drummers after him, you know, the way he played a mid-tempo. Mm. After that, you had great drummers like Jeff Porcaro and Nigel Olsen and Don Henley,
yeah,
who, you know, adopted that kind of simplicity and space. And also the sound, too. I mean, he was revolutionary. And I actually spent 2 days with Jeff Emmerich recording, and asked him a million questions. He was incredibly forthcoming. I teach a class, by the way, at NYU from time to time called The Art of Recording Classic Drums, and 1 week is put to the beauty of Ringo's drum sound. We talk about the early years, and we talk about the tea towel years. And the tea towel years was the beginning of mics being brought into the kit closer to the drum, to, you know, right at the tone, and also baffling drums, which became the norm for the next 10 years or so. I mean, if you listen to just about any hit from 1972 till 78, there's tape on those drums. There's you know, feminine napkins on those drums.
Yeah.
It all started with Ringo going into the kitchen and getting tea towels, because they didn't want to repeat themselves. They wanted a different sound for each record. And there was something about the way the drums, when they were baffled, and the way the baffled drums hit the compressors, that just made the drums more punchy.
Yes.
In the end.
You know, Ringo really earns the same respect as the other three in terms of his musicianship. Why do you think that is?
Ringo just never got in the way of the vocal. You know, he was a song kid. So he always had the vocal in mind and didn't play through it. He arranged his parts. He's not just sitting down and playing. A lot of drummers were arranging parts back then, but they had so much time in the studio, not being session players. He was able to arrange his parts section to section. And maybe the other guys had something to do with that, but he's the one who played it. And that's a lot of information. That's an education right there on how to approach a pop song. And I wrote an article for Modern Drummer called Defending Ringo many years ago, and it was mainly about how in the early years, the reductions of the drums to a second or third generation totally ruined the groove, because he was, you know, pounced on by all of these reductions of tracks to another machine, you know, four tracks down to one track. He's the first one playing, so he's the first one to get reduced. And when you hear the anthology or the bootlegs that I have of just the basics, you really hear that he's laying it down a lot heavier and solid, more solidly than you hear in the end.
Yes.
You know, it says he sounds like Al Jackson Jr. playing a Stax track, which, you know, he was a big fan of.
Yeah.
Al Jackson Jr. And you know, then you you hear tracks like on Leon Russell's first record, Pisces Apple Lady. The incredible drumming, it's Ringo. You know, it's a different engineer. It's a bigger tape deck, so you don't have the reductions. The drumming on Abbey Road is, for the most part, pure. And you can really hear how great he was. As a studio drummer, as a live drummer, right, when people come back, every once in a while, someone's got to come backstage and be an idiot and say, but you're really a good drummer. And we always sort of pounce on that person and just say, have you ever seen the BC concert? I mean, that's really great arena rock drumming, and maybe the first document of arena rock drumming.
Yes.
And then, you know, then it got spliced up and reduced, and, you know, he didn't sound as strong. And, you know, it's not his fault. It's funny, there's this one track, It's All Too Much, off Yellow Submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the song, right?
Yes, absolutely, of course, yeah.
And when I was a kid, you know, and I was into the Beatles, and there was one part where I thought, oh, my God, he's playing 1 and 3 on the snare. He turned it around. He sucks. And for years, I was forgiven for that. And then when the stem started coming out and you hear the drums, you could tell that they took the tape, spliced it, and put it in backwards. So suddenly the groove is 1 and the backbeat is 1 and 3. He didn't do that. They were just really stoned and wanted to do something weird. So they put it in backwards, so now he's 1 and 3 for 8 bars.
Right.
And we do that in the Fab Four now, too, yes. By the way. I have a studio in New York City, and it's a commercial studio, but it's mainly for people I'm producing, and I get a lot of people that come here for an Abbey Road sound or a White Album sound, and yes. So I spent a lot of time just dissecting the production of those records.
That was really cool. It's great to hear somebody that knows what's what about drumming defend Ringo.
Yeah,
and it really makes me want to dig up that Modern Drummer article where he wrote all about defending Ringo, because I get tired of it, quite frankly. I mean, I know how to sum up pretty succinctly what it is about Ringo that makes him brilliant, and how anybody who thinks that he was just some lucky guy is an idiot. But what would be your own favorite Ringo drumming performances?
I think Ticket to Ride, Cry Baby Cry.
That's great.
Yeah, I think that's really
fantastic. He does some great stuff on the White Album.
Yeah, he does. He's saying, really creative on the White
yes, Album. Yes, and speaking of somebody who's played some of that stuff, it ain't easy.
Yeah.
Long, he does some great stuff on.
Right, and I just wanted to refer back to the interview with Rich where he talks about the right hand, left hand.
Yeah.
You know, thing. You can maybe expand a bit on that. You've done some drumming yourself.
Yeah, you know, Ringo was, if this much, I knew that he was a left-handed guy naturally that played a right-handed setup. And not until reading Tune In did I get the whole thing about, you know, his grandmother beating the devil out of him, making him be right-handed when he wasn't. And so he got the right-handed kit, but he still had a certain left-handed dominance, and that informed his fills and his playing style, which made it so unique. Yeah, I get what Rich is saying about, you know, he initially started out trying to do his fills left hand first. If it's not natural to you,
right,
you know, it's not going to be comfortable.
Right.
You know, a drummer like Bunny Carlos from Cheap Trick, during his tenure, I don't know if you ever noticed this, if you watch the band, he would periodically switch his setup from left-handed to right-handed throughout their career.
I didn't know that.
He would always change things up and just, you know, which was an amazing thing. I've never known any other drummer do that.
Right.
Personally, I am so right-handed dominant that I have to do what I can do, which generally is sweeping the kit with my right arm most of the time. My left hand doesn't do so much, but that's just me.
Right.
You do what you can to replicate what you hear. But yeah, Ringo's fills, even before he got the expanded kit, were pretty amazing in that post-touring era of them.
Yeah.
And personally, I think one of the real groundbreaking things was what he did on A Day in a Life.
Yeah. You know, oh, yeah.
You know, then he had a different sound to his toms. They were a lot more almost timpani-like.
Yeah.
The way they rung out.
That's right. And I mean, that's something that George Martin was referring to, you know, when he said not only the way he tuned his kit, but just the, you know, as you say, the timpanis, the toms, his use of them
And the fills are poetic. You know, that particular song. I mean, he's very much listening to what the song's about. You know, it's almost apocalyptic what he's doing on that very dark-themed composition. Let's hear that by just Ringo by himself without the distractions.
understated, right? That's exactly what I was saying. It's really interesting listening to that.
Mm.
It, you know, he's doing something so creative,
mm-hmm.
but he's not drawing attention to himself.
No, he's punctuating the song.
Absolutely.
You know, he holds back when John's singing, and then in the space he has to fill, he almost like a call and response.
Right.
How he responds to what's going on in the song.
Yeah.
Without just overdriving it or doing anything that's going to get in the way. It's so uncluttered.
Yeah.
And I think it was Phil Collins that had said, and I might have said this on the show before, but I'll say it again, you know, no small talent on the drums himself. I mean, he's really amazing, especially in the earlier Genesis stuff. But, you know, he said that you play A Day in the Life for a modern day drummer with that kind of sensibility, they wouldn't know what to do because it is just so unique and so groundbreaking and amazing. You know, for a guy who started out as a club rock and roll basic drummer doing stuff that you can't even define what he's doing as a style.
Yeah.
Simply that he's breaking new ground, and that's what he did.
I'll give a shout out to a friend of mine here, Dan Schwartz, bass player, and he's really, you know, into the whole thing that Ringo is, you know, I mean, he's the vital guy in the Beatles.
Thing, yes.
You know, that, and I get it. I get it, Dan. And it is, it's true that he's so underrated.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people in the know, they get it. They
understand. Because he doesn't draw attention to himself.
Right.
And I think there's a whole persona that goes along with it that where he was, you know, sort of commonly seen as somewhat diminished than the others, you know, the childlike figure as seen in all the films and the Beatle cartoon, you know, which is, it's really unfair, the caricature.
It is.
Because the opposite was the reality. He was a very hip guy.
And he's so solid, you know. I mean, again, you know, I remember Mark Lewisohn's recording sessions book where he sort of said just listening to tape after tape after tape, and Ringo's always on the money. You
right.
know?
Very rare was there a take spoiled because of something
because
he
of
did.
Him. Absolutely.
Yeah, almost never happened.
That's right. That's right. I was a bit surprised, you know, moving forward with when the Beatles did Free as a Bird, the Threatles.
Yes.
Free as a Bird. And Ringo really is just a drum machine.
He's a metronome track. There.
Yeah. And I don't know. I thought, you know, he could have had more than that. I was really disappointed when I first heard the track and heard the drums, to be honest with you, that he was just the metronome. There are no real breaks or anything.
No, no real Ringo fills on that. I suspect that given where they were in their heads, you know, hearing John's voice through the headphones, and, you know, I mean, first off, they were kind of locked into a rhythm anyway, but still, I think there might have been sort of an awe and reverence informing their performances that they just wanted to give John all the space they could and just stay out of the way.
There's an interesting, I don't know if you've seen the Jeff Lynne documentary, Mr. Blue Sky. It was, I think it was on British TV last year, but it's on YouTube.
Yeah.
And there's Ringo's in there, Paul's in the documentary as well. And Ringo's talking about the anthology sessions and that at one point Jeff Lynne is sort of saying about the need for a drum machine.
Mm-hmm.
And Ringo's like, you know, what are you talking about? I am the effing drum machine.
Yes. Don't get me started on my opinion of Jeff Lynne's production.
Right.
Yeah. It's just
That's for another show, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. Yeah. ELO is fine. But anyway, so getting back to the Fab Four, we were lucky enough to score another interview with Jack Petruzzelli, and this is our talk with him, also concerning the Fab Four's current tour and the insights he has to bring to the table at being this musician that has gotten to the heads of the Beatles.
You must be having a time of your life, I'm guessing.
I never take it for granted if you're referring to the Fab Four, what the Fab Four does and how it touches people and how we have a good fan base. It's really a privileged situation, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It never gets old in how we have to just keep honing in this music and make it the best that we possibly can. You know, we're all sticklers for it. I don't think that part of it will ever end. You know, in some ways, I think it's even become more of a priority. Mm-hmm. The band's been together for like 16 years, I think, now.
Mm-hmm.
At least personally, you know, I feel more of a responsibility as we've gotten more popular to make it as best as it can. As it can be.
So you guys are currently doing a Lennon versus McCartney show on the road. Getting inside of how those songs were put together separately must give some insights into their differing approach to creativity. You know, the ongoing myth holds that John was the abrasive rocker and Paul was the tuneful balladeer, but the truth is that both were adept at both. That said, how would you compare and contrast John and Paul in terms of craftsmanship?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, especially that we have just done this show, John versus Paul, you know, tongue-in-cheek. But if you take a song like Maybe I'm Amazed, mm-hmm. and you compare that to Imagine, if you look, regardless of emotionally how those songs affect you, lyric-wise, performance-wise, mm-hmm. as a musician, then you're talking about craftsmanship. If you look at how those songs are composed, you know, McCartney had always expanded his musical vocabulary in a way that, you know, he started using sus chords. He started using common tones and chords that would lead him from one place to another. And then, of course, a creative way, you know, to maybe come out of a dominant chord and not go where you think it's going to go, right? Mm-hmm. He does that, Maybe I'm Amazed. Musically, you know, if you look at Lennon's Imagine, and you think, how much simpler could that get? Or the song God, mm-hmm. you know? Like, how much simpler could that get, but yet be so strong and so poignant, and at the same time still have some cleverness in it? Because I guess maybe this was something that they were used to with one another, that healthy competition, that, you know, Lennon knew, even if he had a simple idea, he was going to find some way to do something different with it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he certainly does in the bridge of that, you know, when he uses the E major chord, you know, and how that goes back to C, you know, how that chord can exist. Now, I don't want to get too heavy when I'm talking about, mm-hmm. you know, a harmony and dissonances in music, but he does something really clever in that. And I think that's the comparison in the craftsmanship. You know, musically, lyrically, that's a whole other thing on their delivery and how they told the story. Mm-hmm. But it's always been a healthy competition between them, in the Beatles and without the Beatles. And that became obvious, too, when, even if they weren't getting along, how you would see they would, you know, Lennon would have some sort of answer to McCartney, you know, whether it was an album cover or whether it was in a tune. He was going to answer something, or he was going to challenge him in a way. Like, that was still going on in their solo years. And you wrote that book on their solo years, right? Is that correct?
Yes, the 2.0 book, and then there's a new one I got out called Solo in the 70s.
Yeah. So, I mean, you must, you know, being a Beatlehead as well, and then looking at that in their solo years, I mean, it's still evident, you know, that was still carrying on, you know, through the first, you know, four records of each of them when they were, you know, still musically active.
Yes.
When we did this Lennon and McCartney, John versus Paul show, I had said to the guys, I think that we should close with A Day in a Life, because it may not have been 50-50 collaboration, you know, however, it's probably the strongest collaboration that we know, mm-hmm. of Lennon and McCartney.
Sure.
And how heavier does that get than that too? You know, unfortunately, we didn't do it. We were going to do it for the encore, but we ran out of time, so we did She Loves You instead.
When you did the show with Danny Harrison recently,
did
you have much input into what songs of George's catalog you guys took on?
Yeah. Oh, with Danny, when Danny came out, like, what song he was going to sing?
Yeah.
Danny approached Jimmy and said, I see that you guys are playing Saturday. Can I come down and sit in? Mm-hmm. And Jimmy's handed him the set list. He goes, pick any song you want. And Danny said, oh, I got to sing Sad Boy Truffle the week after at the Ford Theater. So, you know, I'd love to do Sad Boy Truffle. And that's how it came about, you know?
Oh,
nice when, you know, it's interesting over the years how the Fat Foe has gotten recognized, you know, through people that have been in the Beatle world and you know, whether it's somebody like Danny or whether it's somebody that's worked with them on a musical level, like an engineer, it's nice to be appreciated in that way that, you know, we take this utmost seriously and, you know, we try to represent it as close as we can. You know, we've worked with Jeff Emmerich, you know, Ken Scott's come to shows, you know, Cynthia Lennon, May Pang, Yoko Center, Blessings, and now, you know, Danny Harrison, man, coming and sitting in with us.
Like, wow.
You know, and I look at Danny and I think, what could be more precious to George than his only son? Mm-hmm. You know, and this guy's right here playing with us. It's such a privilege, man. It warms my heart.
When you guys come to Chicago, you're not doing the Lennon-McCartney. You're doing the White Album.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's pick something from White Album. How about one we haven't played on the show yet? How about Happiness Is a Warm Gun?
Happiness Is a Warm Gun. Now here is a great example of a John Lennon song and him challenging himself to write in different time signatures. There's probably three or four different time signatures in that tune. His sense of humor in the lyric is outstanding, even to the point that just blows me away. He read in the paper about the National Trust, which is an organization that volunteers, I think, to go into the parks in London and clean up. And at that time, there was a high level of homelessness or something or whatever, and they were complaining that they had to pick up human waste in the park. So Lennon says he made a soap impression of his wife, ate it, and donated to the National Trust. I mean, here we are. I mean, it's hilarious, and at the same time, it's childish, right?
Right.
I mean, but, I mean, that's, you know, you have that, and then you have everything that combines the doo-wop 50s with the background vocals to, you know, those guys working together as a band to work in those different time signatures. Lennon's grittiness in those guitar lines. It's one of my favorite songs to play. Rich Pagano sings it, and he sings it perfect. He just sings it great. The band, especially for the White Album, it's my favorite record to perform live because I think it highlights what the Fat Foe does.
She's not who misses much. Oh yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust.
Do me no harm. Oh, yeah. Because
I have to say, great interview, and Happiness is a Warm Gun is one of my personal favorites.
Yes.
You know, if I had to take one of the tracks to a desert island with me, that mm-hmm. would be right up there.
And as he says, you know, it is just an incredible band performance. And that's an album that has quite a few of them, notably on a lot of John's songs.
Yes.
Because Paul wasn't running off to record his own parts separately. But
right.
And that's a tricky song.
Well, it's like in three phases, isn't
yeah.
it? It's like three songs put
yeah.
together.
Which
yeah.
is funny, because that was the whole Paul thing that, you know, defined his solo career, was take all these little pastiches and throw them together, like an Uncle Albert or a Band
right.
on the Run.
Right.
And here's John doing it, which is a pretty uncommon thing.
Well, you know, if you recall in the 1970 interview for Rolling Stone with mm-hmm. Jan Wenner, that John says at one point, he says, you know, one of the things I have to admit that I miss about being in the Beatles was that incredible understanding that we
yes.
had, you know, that over developed over years, and I could just look at one of them and a certain look or a,
yeah, make a
wink,
sound.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly, and they know where I'm going.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's huge. That is something that is an added value to the Beatles' career, that they'd been putting in their 10,000 hours in Hamburg and Liverpool, and just, I mean, not with Ringo the entire time, but still, you know, he was in this parallel career with theirs, so he knew the score,
yeah.
and he just fit right in. And yeah, they were just this well-oiled machine by the time the Fame hit in 63, 64, and they've been working their tails off all that time. They were just such a tight unit. And we've talked about in the one show we did in the concerts,
yeah.
you know, by 64, the Coliseum show, which Rich also cited, you know, you want to hear what Ringo can do and what those four guys can do as a band, there you go. So it's amazing that 4 years later, here they are doing the White Album, and they could still summon up that dynamic of the four of them just playing. And you know, that particular song, which has got so many rhythm shifts in it, you know, which is so typical of John. It's funny that the When I Hold You part at the end,
yeah,
and they're sort of almost doing like a waltz time, and Ringo's playing a straight 4-4.
Yes.
It's like, I don't know if he intuited that or he just figured out, you know, that was the way to go with that. And they all, at the end of the passage, they all land on the same spot.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. And I know I've read that they were very proud of that track as something where they really, you know, pulled together as a band and did a tricky thing and really made it solid. So
I mean, you know, there's something to be said as well that in those days, people got signed, you know, having been a live act,
mm-hmm.
right? And that they've been performing, as the Beatles had been for years. That was a very common thing. They'd have to do their time gigging.
Yes.
And then hopefully get a recording contract.
Right.
And so by the time they're in the studio, they've gelled as a band.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, the last 20 years or whatever, the way the music business has gone with home recordings and stuff,
mm-hmm.
there are some, you know, people who've got almost no live experience.
Right.
You know,
they've lost
to go to the
that whole apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Experience.
That said,
mm-hmm.
months after the White Album, we get into the Get Back sessions,
mm-hmm.
and then you listen to that stuff where the Beatles are, we had that in the live episode, you know, where mm-hmm. they're even doing some tracks that they'd done in the studio just 5 or 6 years before, and it's
yeah.
terrible.
It's
like
terrible.
They're not together at
well,
all.
And there's heroin.
Yeah.
There's the lack of will in and camaraderie.
Mm.
You know, you can't underestimate, you know, the difference between when that esprit de corps is in place and when it's not.
Absolutely.
And there's your A and B, the White Album versus the Let It Be sessions.
Yeah. It is amazing, isn't it? It's
yeah.
within months. And it's like, yeah, they're just not into it. And there's too much messing around and not giving a damn.
Listlessness and, yeah,
yeah,
and no motivation,
and
no
almost
will.
Almost undermining. You know, someone does one
yeah.
song, well, you'll undermine it.
Yeah, subconscious sabotage.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
No, subconscious sabotage.
Exactly.
So with that, I think we got some nice insights out of the Fab Four guys.
Yeah.
As musicians.
Absolutely. You know, it's a different level of credibility for me when guys are able to really combine, you know, trying to faithfully recreate the songs, but add their own personality to it, you know, their own take on it, and do that seamlessly. And
mm-hmm.
I think these guys actually do achieve that. And as I said, it's rare for me to be singing the praises of a covers band, especially a Beatles covers band.
Right.
But this one gets the vote for me.
Yeah. And beyond just being able to do this stuff in a studio, which would be, you know, a great skill set unto itself, the fact that they are such great entertainers and put on a great show.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thanks to the Fab Four for availing themselves for the interviews and putting on a great show. And do check them out if you see them on the road, folks.
And thanks to you for co-hosting this show with me.
Oh, it's understood, Richard.
Yeah,
it's understood.
Okay, I just want to put that out.
Okay. Thanks for listening, people. This is Robert.
And this is Richard. And this has been Something
About
the Beatles.
Something About the Beatles. Recorded at Strad Studios, produced by Thomas Repetney. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song recorded by the Corgis.